Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin. Today is July 20th, 2005. This is a re-interview with Professor Stephen Bourne of Urban and Regional Planning concerning his affiliation with UW Extension. The original interview section of the this process has been regretfully erased. So with the courtesy of Steve, we are reconducting the interview. So Steve, I will ask you now to begin commenting on your affiliation with the Extension, how it influenced your career, and the significance of your time with the Extension and your subsequent teaching and professional career outside of the university.
Okay. Well, I think I indicated earlier, Bob, that I came back here in 1969 to work for University Extension as a specialist and specifically to be the director of the Inland Lake Demonstration Project, which was a project funded by the Upper Great Lakes Regional Commission that ran out to close to $1.5 million over 5 years and dealt with not just lake restoration and management, but shoreland management, on-site waste disposal, dealing with large lakes in the state like the Chippewa flowage and a whole host of things, and culminated in really pioneering legislation with regard to lake management and the creation of new special purpose units to manage lakes. So we took that program over 5 years from a applied research realm to an application, testing, and public policy relevance by the creation of these new laws. And in fact, Wisconsin has continued to build on that as one of the national leaders in lakes management, working really on a partnership basis between the DNR, nonprofit, non-governmental organizations, and the university and University Extension. And that was the theme, really, and the structural underpinning of that project. So when I came back, lakes and shorelands were the vehicle by which my extension outreach programming was initially conducted, although into that project I also became the chair of the Environmental Resources Center, which had been set up to deal with interdisciplinary environmental matters in outreach education and programming.
Can you give me a year for this?
Early 70s.
Okay.
The Inland Lake Project ran from 1969 to 1974 when we capitalized on building a groundswell of support amongst citizens throughout the state, working carefully with policymakers and agency people in a bipartisan fashion enact the lake management laws, which in fact have carried over in revised form to the present day. There are five overall substantive themes, at least that's the way I'll break it up, to the work I've done wearing my extension hat. And as I indicated in earlier interviews, there's a very close set of linkages between my research and applied research, my teaching, my outreach and public policy education. They become quite seamless, actually, hopefully symbolic of the Wisconsin idea in practice. And so as I talk about my extension work and extension personalities, I can't help but harken back to work that was going on of a research mode or where students have been engaged in these processes. So building on the lakes programming in the ensuing 30-odd years, my programming has dealt with river protection planning and management, with groundwater protection planning and management, broadly with water and related resources planning, including not just lakes, rivers, wetlands, and so forth, but the state coastal management program and dealing with Great Lakes issues. Certainly a large part of my work has been focused on planning and management institutional innovations, including evaluation approaches. And in that realm, I would put my work dealing with integrated planning and management, experimentation with collaborative approaches and coordinated approaches to management, and an increasing focus on local watershed stewardship, building the capacity, the civic capacity in Wisconsin and elsewhere, to assume some responsibility for managing local watersheds, both the land and water, the biotic, abiotic resources, because really these watersheds are nothing more than communities connected by water, and local citizens have to take some ownership in that realm. And the final area, broadly grouped, would be land use planning and land conservation. Lots of other things have come into my professional portfolio over the years, from mining and mineral resource development, metallics and non-metallics, land use planning of a variety of types, but I would just group all of these into these areas. The topical areas are all characterized by a way of approaching the extension programming and outreach work I did. Every project is not a project. They've all been multi-year in nature. I've been focused not on doing something that was from year one to year three and then move on, but really embedding that work in the way Wisconsin and other governments are involved in managing their resources. And in many cases, as you'll see when I get to a couple of specifics here, this work is extended over several decades. Second of all, almost all the work I've taken on has been very much results-oriented. That is, that the research has led to significant changes or innovations in planning and managing environmental resources, both in our state and beyond. I think a third characteristic of my outreach work is that it's done as a collaborative undertaking, often with other UW Extension faculty, but probably even more often with agency personnel, with non-governmental personnel, and with other interested parties and clients. All the work is research-based, draws upon not only my own applied research and demonstration efforts, but others' work. And transferring this research work to real-life problem settings through creating new institutions and programs and activities has been a hallmark of my efforts here. I've also, I think, tried to consistently capitalize on the comparative advantages of working in an integrated academic department, integrated in the sense that there are both extension components and the traditional research and teaching components. And so through class workshops, through projects, a whole variety of activities, work was brought to bear that dealt with problems in these topical areas. And I'll give you some specific examples of workshops involving my students that helped me further my extension work, which fed directly into public policy education and ultimately new laws and programs here and elsewhere. I think the other characteristic of a lot of the work I've done is in these issues that I've identified earlier here, that many of these things were really emerging public policy issues, and I managed to engage them early on before they were really on the political radar screen. And these were not necessarily driven by agents. These were things you could see emerging in trends as issues that had longevity and importance to the state, and we were able to tackle them over time frames and in ways that put us sometimes in front of some of the problems. Maybe the best way I can tell the story is through using some of these themes to illustrate selectively some brief success stories. I talked a little bit about the Inland Lakes Demonstration Project, which was a national hallmark project.
Yes.
Probably the great success of the technical assistance funding from the Upper Great Lakes Regional Commission. But let me talk a little bit now about the efforts in trying to improve river protection and management. And you get some idea of the wide range of pieces that one brings together to make whole cloth in these subject matter areas. My interest in activity with regard to river protection and management outside of fishing grew out of watershed and water quality educational efforts in the 1970s and 1980s. In 1986, with Bill Cinzoni and Ken Potter, colleagues from the university in the Water Resources Program, we led a year-long workshop on the Black Earth Creek, which ultimately led to the formation of the Watershed Association and also to one of the most successful non-point source water pollution abatement projects conducted in the state. More than $1.5 million got targeted into that watershed, almost as a direct outgrowth of that stage-setting work, both compiling a lot of the resource inventory work, analysis of problems, recommendations on alternative directions, institutional change, and in fact, the Black Earth Creek area has been a little personal laboratory for me in many ways over the years, but it was launched through an academic or campus-based workshop, but extended into my extension and public policy education work. So that was a specific little geography. In 1994, in conjunction with DNR and the fledgling River Alliance of Wisconsin, a non-governmental organization of which I was a founding board member, and which incidentally is now one of the largest and most successful statewide citizen river advocacy groups in the U.S., we organized a statewide conference, lots of different stakeholders, to shape the future of Wisconsin rivers and watersheds. And in many regards, the objectives of this conference have been substantially realized over the last decade or so, in which we've improved awareness of river values and built a lot of local organizations concerned with long-term river stewardship, helped shape state policy agendas, much better information for these kind of things. But the conference itself was an extension activity for me, and I co-edited the documentation of the conference, the proceedings, and with my graduate students, prepared the key University Extension publication for conferees, which was called A Citizen's Guide to Governmental River Management and Protection Programs and Agencies in Wisconsin. Because up until then, people couldn't answer the question, who's responsible for what? And so we wanted to kind of provide a roadmap to sort that out. Then, working with agency, legislative, and non-governmental leaders, I helped design legislation that partly was an outgrowth of that conference, which is now enacted, establishing a Rivers and Streams Protection Partnership and a Grant Assistance Program. And this was partly modeled on my earlier work with regard to Wisconsin Lake Management and the Wisconsin Lakes Partnership. This entire effort was informed by my applied research on river and watershed management in the U.S. and internationally, especially through a number of Wisconsin-oriented efforts with my students. For example, in one of my water policy classes, we did a survey and compiled a publication on the Emerging Watershed Approach, a survey of Wisconsin community-based watershed organizations, which began the business of having some intelligence on who was doing what with regard to river protection and management at the local level in the state, and that's grown enormously. And in the Black Earth Creek watershed, I continued to serve for 15 years as president of the local watershed association and gaining knowledge about how these things, multi-stakeholder, multi-governmental, multi-interest kinds of things, how they work in practice. I think my work in river protection and management also benefited from the success of the Kickapoo River Conservation Project, which was a $500,000, 3-year partnership effort that we brought into the state through Trout Unlimited, but then worked with local agencies and the State Priority Watershed Program and various conservation groups to demonstrate and institutionalize a science-based, grassroots-oriented watershed management approach. And I had been looking for an opportunity to put some of this integrated watershed management on the ground, and this was a vehicle, and I served as a senior project advisor for that and hired one of my graduate students to be the project director, Laura Hewitt, did a marvelous job and has gone on to become the National Watershed Programs Director for Trout Unlimited.
Steve, let me interrupt. Were you teaching the entire time you were working with the Extension?
Yes. I taught, on average, a course and a half a year. So it would be 2 courses 1 year, 1 course another, fragmentary participation in other classes. And I continued to teach even while I was on leave as state planning director, but on a far more limited basis. I would just note one specific issue which emerged from the conference, but it was an issue I'd been involved with since the 1970s, which, while it's a little sidebar in the river protection and management area, actually is a major initiative nationally and internationally now, It involved dam removal and river restoration. A dam is a cataclysmic event in the life of a river. It changes energy flows, it interrupts biologic movements of fish and other aquatic critters. And the whole question was, what would happen with all the dams we put in river systems as they aged, became unsafe? In some cases, the environmental consequences of putting these dams on a lot of our smaller river systems was becoming evident. And it was certainly important in Wisconsin, where there were some 3,600 small dams due to the mill dam building era back in the 1800s in this state. Many of these were facing removal for safety reasons, or communities were facing costly rehabilitation. And so working with my graduate students again in one of my water policy classes, we prepared a report that examined not the biologic, but the socioeconomic and institutional dimensions of dam removal, really digesting the Wisconsin experience with this river restoration approach that a decade earlier would be almost unthinkable. I also went on then to publish a major popular science piece in Encyclopedia Britannica on the future of the world's dams, including an assessment of impacts of dams on river systems. And so there was a lot of work done there, and in conjunction with DNR staff and other environmental and conservation interests, legislation was developed and enacted to provide both funding and authority for dam removal for environmental goals as well as for public safety objectives. And in a few short years, really, partly owing to my involvement being on the board of the River Alliance of Wisconsin, and partly because at that point I was national chair of Trout Unlimited of the National Resource Board, both of those organizations assigned a high priority to dam removal. And so dam removal and river restoration had become and continues to be a major national public policy issue, and we had the opportunity to do some early groundbreaking work in many ways. And it's hard to trace through the flow and attribute directly to work I was involved with exactly how much of the dam removal, river restoration work that has taken place here and elsewhere, what those relationships are. But certainly we did some of the early on seminal work, both in the practical action-oriented way, as well as in some of the research arenas. So that gives you some example of something that started back in the 70s and carried on up till today, where even now I'm an active conservation lobbyist in the area of dam removal and dealing with communities in terms of the benefits of dam removal and how one goes about it and how one deals with the multiple interests in communities. All of that part of extension work and part of work broadly in river restoration and management. So it gives you a flavor in this one subject matter area. Let me give you another one that would help understand how those characteristics or process approaches were put to work, this time in the area of groundwater protection planning and management. Remember that I had a PhD in hydrogeology, had worked in groundwater, yes. Actually done some consulting in Wisconsin in wastewater disposal and groundwater management. So this is a long-standing effort with roots in my early work related to lake management and development. In the early 1980s, I led an extension task force on groundwater management education. So extension could begin dealing with the emerging groundwater problems. And in fact, working with colleagues in the Wisconsin Geological Survey, Gary Jackson in the Environmental Resources Center, Ron Hennings, Buzz Ostrom, who was the director of the survey, and certainly Dave Stevenson, who had been my PhD advisor but was now doing extension work in groundwater. A lot of collaborative work here to put groundwater in the forefront, to make the hidden treasure, the hidden resource, a more evident resource and make its importance to the state of Wisconsin much clearer so it would get the management attention that it warranted. Working with Extension colleagues, and in particular Doug Yangin, who I've noted earlier, who was my partner in the lake management project and was also a cohort in the groundwater arena, we got funding for and co-directed a multi-state groundwater policy education project, which was an applied research effort to help build the momentum for groundwater management reform in Wisconsin and elsewhere. I played a public policy education role. I worked with the governor, at one point was the governor's representative as we were developing the 1984 groundwater quality legislation in Wisconsin.
Who was the governor?
At that point in time, it was Tony Earle. And Mary Lou Munce was one of the principal legislators involved in developing this legislation, along with some other key operatives in the legislature. But what we were doing was working with the legislature and the governor and other interests in drafting significant portions of Wisconsin's groundwater legislation. And there was a major applied research effort going on in this arena. For example, I co-authored a piece on a guide to groundwater quality planning and management for local governments, which was the kind of the Bible for local governments for years who wanted to deal with their local groundwater problems, and we rolled that out working collaboratively with Rock County to see how we could put that into practice. Another effort was research on how the state might use wellhead protection districts in Wisconsin to protect the groundwater water supplies, and in fact programs have moved ahead based on that in the ensuing years. In the early 1990s, 1991, working in cooperation again with many stakeholder interests, I took the co-lead with Doug Yangan in organizing a major conference on working together to manage Wisconsin's groundwater, and we were looking to try to recognize next steps. I co-edited the proceedings that documented that statewide event, and many of the recommendations stemming from that conference have now been implemented. Such things as improving monitoring programs and data collection and sharing, educational activities, better interagency coordination. And at the initiative of the State Groundwater Coordinating Committee, which has been successfully functioning here for 20 years and for which I wrote the organic legislation, and which has been recognized nationally as a significant innovation in coordinating multiple state agencies and local governments in groundwater management. They moved ahead looking at groundwater quality and organizing a follow-up conference 10 years later, which I gave one of the keynote talks and talked about future directions in groundwater. Proceedings came out of that. A person who had been a student of mine, Tim Asplund, took a key role in coordinating much of that work. And so it continued leading up in the very recent past here to legislation dealing with groundwater quantity management. But all this work on groundwater was also informed by practical work at the local level. One of the county executives in Dane County asked me to chair a county executive safe drinking water task force, and the recommendations and experience there was very useful in shaping what we were recommending at larger scales. But in the last 4 or 5 years, concerns about groundwater and competing uses for groundwater became a real hot-button item in Wisconsin, particularly when Perrier proposed coming in and exploiting springs up in along the McCann River to produce yuppie water of one sort or another, spring water, and it became very contentious. And so this proposal by a large bottled water company for groundwater extraction really triggered a concern about, did we have the right laws in place to manage groundwater quantity? We had dealt with groundwater quantity almost 20 years earlier. So again, working with my graduate students, we prepared the definitive University Extension report called Modernizing Wisconsin Groundwater Management, which was really applied research, which really established the framework and the array of options for the legislative dialogue which took place. Results of that work were widely circulated, and in fact I had my students present it to the Wisconsin Senate with me there as we framed out these new directions for groundwater management. And in fact, in the next year or so, unlike a lot of our recent legislative history, key legislators including Dwayne Johnsrud and Senator Neil Kedzie, took the lead in a very civil, open, transparent, science-based process. I served in a variety of capacities working with groups on that. The River Alliance had taken some lead role in working with the potato and vegetable growers, and I had linkages into that operation. Of course, through the University Extension, and others. But the upshot is that with a whole host of people playing pivotal roles, Wisconsin was able to enact really pioneering first steps, but very pioneering groundwater quantity management legislation as an outgrowth of that.
Steve, can I ask you to comment on the fact that historically Wisconsin has been considered a laboratory for all kinds of issues of social policy, a laboratory for the nation? It sounds to me like what you were doing with groundwater here fits into that category.
Right. Wisconsin has been an innovator, less so, unfortunately, in the last few years. I think we found ourselves in a political and fiscal situation where we're kind of racing downwards towards the middle. And leadership and innovative roles, particularly in environmental management and conservation, have been hard to come by. But certainly in the area of groundwater and lakes and river protection and dam removal. And a good example of this is my work in coastal management, done both within my role as an extension educator, but more particularly, as we'll talk about on at another time, in my role as a state agency official, and developing the state's coastal management program to deal with Great Lakes management. But that followed many of the same precepts that we've outlined here, and in fact built upon Wisconsin's early on innovation before I was in Wisconsin, building on Gaylord Nelson and Warren Knoll's work, and in particular Jake Boischer in the law school. I was in Jake's last law class. He died shortly after that. Huh. One of the seminal figures in conservation history in Wisconsin. But Jake just emptied out his files in enacting the 1965 water resources legislation, which provided for shoreland and floodplain zoning. Wisconsin pioneered nationally in this, and much of what got done subsequently in enacting the national coastal management programs built upon that kind of a base. So it was Wisconsin as an innovator, and we continue to do work in the coastal management area, where we were the first approved Great Lakes State. It was based upon partnerships. It was based upon this collaborative work, a lot of university involvement, and some institutional innovations in how we went about it. And in fact, while I was in state government, we used one of our water resources management workshops at the university, run by my colleague Erhard Joris and Ken Potter and others, to tackle the whole business of creating a model to understand Great Lakes levels and flows, which up until then only the Corps of Engineers had a model, and people were very suspect about their views for managing the Great Lakes. So in coastal management and all these other areas, which you see as a long-standing engagement, but with a set of protocols for engagement, cultural ways of coming at the problem, ways of engaging other parties, ways of bringing scientific analysis and information into the decision-making process, ways of magnifying your capacity through using students and other kinds of interested parties, so that it was really a transparent, open, engaging, creative kind of process, and that's why I think we got so much done.
Would you say that your ties to the extension were actually the highlight of your intellectual experience at the university, because it afforded you the opportunity to combine action with knowledge?
I would say it was not the most significant tie. It was one of several ties, which I'd probably weight equally. Extension, during the first 25 years of my career, gave me a very broad leash. And I'll talk in a minute about some of the administrative personalities and so forth. And I was a workaholic and worked 75 or 80 hours a week. I was very results-oriented, and I increasingly developed experience and a capacity to tackle these kinds of projects and to engage the extension apparatus. But it was equally important. I had the academic base, and I was able to network and build outside with the state agencies and other interests, and that students were injected into the process. They were all part and parcel of what I was about.
Uh-huh.
And I think one other area I'll comment on, there's no reason to belabor this too much, is the whole area of institutional innovations. Much of my applied research and scholarly publications over the past few decades addressed three kinds of themes: the whole theory and practice of integrated environmental planning and management. I talk elsewhere in these interviews about my signature of being the great coordinator, but
yes.
Research on interagency and intergovernmental coordination, and thirdly, place-based or community-based collaborative watershed planning and management. And this research work has provided the knowledge base for my work at the local level, whether it's a Black Earth Creek or other small watershed, on up to international levels where I recently worked with the European Union on integrated environmental management and their water framework directive. But there's an exploding watershed movement worldwide, and so a lot of the research I've been able to do has led me into trying to further practice in this whole area, this emerging area of resource stewardship. And the evaluation frameworks that we developed, in particular some work I did under funding from the National Academy of Public Administration with one of my PhD students, Ken Jensko, put in place a very robust evaluation framework for looking at these kinds of things. And consequently, I wound up doing a lot of watershed evaluation work. So these institutional innovations and work here has shaped future directions for watershed management in Wisconsin. But also elsewhere, I did some work with some students on, and a person named Jeff Mayers did a master's thesis with us, and we published a nice technical piece in the journal Environmental Management called The Exceptional Waters Approach to Dealing with Cold Water Management, and it was really about integration and coordination, tying the pieces together to get whole cloth, long-range, science-based management, and the province of Ontario, where I've had colleagues and have been their keynote speaker at major conservation conferences up there, and also I'm tied into Trout Unlimited in Canada, actually serving on their board now. They went ahead and implemented this exceptional waters approach in a very explicit kind of way.
Huh.
So it's just another example of sort of innovations which are hatched in applied research and demonstration efforts, which are refined and collated and amplified through student engagement and work and through teaching, and which are rolled out into application forms both within government and without. So that's kind of a flavor. I should note one other public policy outreach initiative, but this one I would not credit very much to my linkage with Extension, because as I'll note in a little while, after 25 very positive years with Extension, changes in administration and changes in sort of the behavior of Extension led to my decoupling from Extension since restricted from the organization. Continued to do the same kind of work I did before, working, as you would know, Bob, because you were the director of the Wisconsin Academy of Science, Arts, and Letters at the time, with one of their innovative vanguard projects, looking at the Wisconsin idea. It was the first really major one out of the chute, called the Waters of Wisconsin, where I had the opportunity to co-chair and provide a lot of direction to that effort, working with John Magnuson, the director of the Limnology Lab, an eminent limnologist, global climate change expert, and Patricia Leavenworth, a wonderful person who was the state conservationist for the Natural Resources Conservation Service, and with top-notch staff, Kurt Meining, noted environmental historian, Leopold's biographer, Mike Striegel, a young guy at the Academy, and a whole host of people. That work went on for 3 years, engaged the citizens of Wisconsin in a dialogue about water, produced some real landmark conferences, particularly because they crossed the gulf between the social sciences and humanities and the biophysical engineering
right.
sciences. And in fact, the conference, the final conference, was one that was characterized by poetry and music as by science. And it was a real benchmark event for people because they recognized that those were elements of the passions that drive humans and change behavior, and if we're ever going to really get the nurturing and caring that our water resources need, people are going to have to care first.
Mm-hmm.
And so that that project produced some very seminal publications. Some of it has carried on and been embedded in activities around the state by agencies and non-governmental interests, and to some degree the pioneering groundwater legislation that the governor signed into law in 2004 was an outgrowth of recommendations that were in the Waters of Wisconsin final report. And in fact, when we gave the governor the Waters of Wisconsin final report, he asked whether or not he would be able a year later to sign groundwater legislation, and through work of a lot of involved people, including Todd Ames, who had been involved in the Waters of Wisconsin project, had been the director of the River Alliance of Wisconsin, and is now the Waters Czar for DNR, we were able to make that happen, much, I think, to Governor Doyle's surprise, his admitted surprise, that it could happen so fast in such a hostile political environment as we've encountered in the state. So I've tried to paint a picture here of extension activities. I do want to just comment on a couple of things that are exemplars of the way Extension, as an organization, was able to draw upon its community-based faculty, state-based specialists to tackle some of these big problems. And we did it with a groundwater task force in the early 1980s. We were able to mobilize resources, develop programs, carry them out throughout the state. And again, we did it in 1990 and 91, where I chaired the Extension Water Resources Coordinating Committee, trying to put together the many pieces, some related to the economy, some related to the environment, some related to community development, but all of them related to water, so that Extension would know what one hand would know what the other was doing. We would have both an efficient and effective program delivery, and that was a very, very successful effort. And those kinds of coordinating efforts, pulling the pieces together, working in teams, figuring out realistic kinds of approaches that you can move ahead with, soliciting support from administrators and other key parties, those were important hallmarks of my work in Extension and the character of Extension. That was the way Extension was when I came into Extension, and it was a wonderful climate to do that up until about the mid-90s when there were administrative changes. And I think at this point it would probably be appropriate if I talk a little bit about and candidly, I guess, about a time stream of Extension administrators. There are many organizational changes in Extension over the 30-odd years that I have been here, from creating a separate university extension and pulling it out of the campuses, and various reformulations and arrangements for delivery of extension programs with campuses. I'm going to focus on a few personalities. When I came back in 1969, Henry Algren was the dean of the chancellor of Extension. He loved the work we were doing, showcased the Inland Lake Project. He went on to become Undersecretary of Agriculture for Rural Development. Very positive. A person named Gail Vandenberg was the dean in Extension at that point. Highly supportive. A traditional agriculture kind of guy, but with a very great vision of Extension outreach education and its potential, built on the history of the land-grant model. He was succeeded by Bob Reek, who was a great champion and supporter, and it was under Reek that we created, as I recall, these various program areas where there were program leaders designated. Ours was the Community Natural Resource Economic Development Area, which I codenamed as Aisha Summersand, who became dean and was the program leader for that area, CONRAD, and that kind of stuff, the acronym. But all of these people were very able, good people. Aisha, when she became dean, was as good as it gets in my book. She was facilitative, positive, strong. She was a yes person. She understood the value of tying together the pieces. She understood what creativity was about, and in terms of the faculty, was very, very respectful of faculty roles. And so these were exciting times in Extension, and most of these things I was doing were happening under that watch.
Steve, give us a time period for when Aisha was there.
She must have come in as dean in probably the mid-80s, something like that. I had worked with her. In fact, she had worked as within the Recreation Resources Center and Extension, was director of that. When I went into state government, I worked with her and other colleagues in Extension to create one of the winning Energy Extension Service grants. We got $1 million to do energy conservation work that build up on our land grant style, and Aisha was pivotal and supportive in making that happen. I, of course, was also the state energy director by then, was able to influence pretty much the shape of what our submission would look like, and we worked with lots of good people in extension. So that was an extremely positive working relationship. There was a negative or two along the way. Early on in my career, when Henry Algren left as chancellor, somebody was brought in as chancellor from the University of Missouri, a chap named Gene Evans, actually. Chancellor of the then newly created separate extension. And it became very evident to anybody who was watchful that Gene Evans was way over his head, a very nice man. I don't know, there are rumors that he was in some trouble in Missouri when he left. He was recruited here. But it was clear as you watched him dealing with the Board of Regents and others that this was a more complicated organism than he was used to dealing with. He didn't understand our kind of tradition of faculty roles here. And the incompetence grew, and there were also some fiscal stresses. Nobody in the central administration of the university hierarchy, the university system hierarchy, took any action on this kind of thing, much to our dismay. And I've always been somewhat dismayed about the temerity of central administration to engage actively in some of these areas. It's difficult enough to figure out what many of these people are doing in central, but there's a lot of well-paid administrators there. And ultimately, the oversight of the individual units within the system ought to be part of somebody's purview. And it seemed to us that nobody was watching the store, not getting any response through normal administrative channels and recognizing problems with this chancellor. Extension faculty formed a Senate Select Committee, faculty Senate Select Committee, to review happenings in extension, particularly the administrative performance in extension. It was really a review of the chancellor. And Blake Kellogg, who had been Governor Pat Lucey's press secretary early on, he moved into extension communications, a very noted extension and campus-based researcher. John Shaneman co-chaired that from the College of Agriculture. That was very important, a dominant part of the extension operation. And we spent a year gathering data, diverted to some degree from our substantive academic work to do work that I thought ought to have been done by the administration. But ultimately, essentially casting a vote of no confidence for the chancellor, and with a lot of documentation as to why, with a lot of very eminent extension faculty interviewed and part of the whole process. And within a matter of about 6 months, Evans was gone after that. But it always left me suspicious about the willingness of administrators to do some of the tough jobs in confronting lack of performance rather than circling the wagon to protect their brethren and being very cautious about accusations of non-performance from their faculty ranks. And over the years, as I've talked about elsewhere in these interviews, I have a high regard for a number of the people who have been chancellors and here chancellors and deans with an extension. Certainly a very high regard for Catherine Lyle and the difficult job she did in the system for many, many years. But I also have noticed this great tendency of university administrators to sometimes qualify as the state invertebrate and lack the backbone to really engage in confrontational things, wanting to stay clear of any kind of public conflict, want to protect the university's name, and often protect counterpart administrators and other units. And I think there's way too much of that. You need a collaborative environment, but you also, somebody has to have oversight for performance on the administrative side of things. And I always thought it was problematic that the faculty had to take the lead. And so many faculty, there were probably 25 or 30 on this committee involved in putting this together and doing all the networking and communication sharing and meetings and almost a plebiscite amongst the ranks of extension faculty to finally say, look, this is a job that's not being performed well, and here's some of the metrics of what's wrong. Do something about this.
So, Steve, is that perspective of yours grounded in your work in private industry before you became an academic? Or does it go farther back to watching your dad as a labor organizer?
No, it's a combination of things. It seems to me people in administrative roles, and historically these have been a lot more centralized, top-down kinds of positions than the kind of collaborative culture that's emerged in the last decade or so, more collaborative in some of these roles, and that oversight and the willingness to make some tough calls, and some of the toughest calls are in personnel evaluations of peers in right. high administrative ranks. I'm convinced that people can drift through this system in very, very highly placed administrative, well-played administrative ranks without anybody knowing for a year or two how well they're doing, without anybody really holding them accountable. And we've seen ultimately some chancellors at campus units move on through under one auspices or another, but it's very clumsy in an academic setting. But I think there is, particularly with new institutional arrangements like Extension had, an obligation to provide kind of oversight and guidance as to how the new person is working out. And when there are signs of things being wrong, a willingness to intervene and make corrections. And I think dumping that or allowing that to be dumped, or legislators perversely will capitalize on these kinds of events, it winds up affecting the image, the public perspective of the university, and in many ways our funding base and long-term support for the university. So it's understandable. Part of that, however, is making the system work. And it's one of the things that I liked about Shalala. She was very tough in this area, but willing to make some decisions and say the chips, you know, will fall here. Mm-hmm. So that gives you a little panoramic view. So I've indicated it was somewhat idyllic in Extension with high caliber mm-hmm. Extension administrators. Bud Jordahl at one point along the way was involved as a program leader and certainly a wonderful guy to work with. Marvin Beatty was another collaborator of mine. He was the first chair of the Environmental Resources Center, a soil scientist here, went on to become a program leader while I became the second chair of the Environmental Resources Center. And these were all wonderful people to work with, as well as a whole retinue of spectacular colleagues who had joint appointments, people like Dick Barrows, who did a lot of work in ag lands preservation and economic analysis of public lands acquisition. We all worked as a team within Extension, within the campus, and we had the kind of leadership that respected us and understood our desire to kind of grow professionally and to collaborate together. Someplace along the line, that changed for me. And I indicated that using the Waters of Wisconsin, or what we nicknamed the WOW effort, right. as my point of departure, where I stopped working with Extension, basically. I talked to Extension meetings when asked to do so. I counseled people on Extension careers. But I very much severed, and it happened in a rather ugly way, actually. I just got tired of non-performance, and now you can see the roots of this. And there was a new dean after Aisha Summersand left. He had been her lieutenant. He was a third choice for that position. He was a good lieutenant. I always wondered whether he had the leadership attributes. A nice enough guy. However, he wound up appointing some people in program leader roles.
And this dean, new dean's name?
Was Carl O'Connor.
Okay.
And the particular person that I ultimately had the flashpoint run-ins with was a program leader named Pat Walsh, a nice enough guy and a good Extension educator. He was so far over his head from the day he took the job. By this point in time, I'd had more administrative experience than all those guys put together, frankly. Mm-hmm. And my tolerance for a kind of naivete about organizational issues, about engaging in ways that didn't get traction and all kinds of mistakes that were made early on, and really what I thought was second-rate leadership. I finally watched this go on. Walsh had no understanding of the way I worked in terms of the long-term things and in terms of my view of Extension as really the public service that changed the culture of parts of Wisconsin, the area you're working in.
Yes.
Whether it was Bob Gard working in local arts theaters or somebody else working and creating the fabric for local stewardship of rivers, these are changes that happen over eons almost. Mm-hmm. But they're dramatic in the end, and they require all these kinds of things I've been talking about. This was a guy who was a myopic guy, very much agent-driven, kind of a bean counter in some ways, and had no understanding of how to pull together the coordinative apparatus in a management setting. And it led to some real hostilities between he and I. I finally sat down and wrote a 6 or 7 page email, widely circulated, including to top administration, calling for his reassignment.
Really?
That there was other things he could do competently and he ought to go do them. Well, this is after I had talked with deans and other people about this performance, and nobody was prepared to make. They recognized limitations, but they weren't willing to make adjustments. And Extension was very lucky at that time. The money was flowing through the system throughout the early 90s. Had this been happening in mid-90s, had this happened at a time when the budget wrench was really crunching down, that whole organization would have been close to going belly up under the kind of leadership they were getting. There was a very good chancellor at an earlier point in time named Pat Boyle, who went on to become a regent, who provided stellar leadership for Extension. But at this cooperative Extension level, when Aisha Summersand left, things began to deteriorate. Although there were some new initiatives in forestry, and Carl O'Connor did some decent things. What happened, however, is that by this point, I think I was chair of the Department of Urban and Regional Planning, Integrated Department, working with CALS and LNS. And Abe Aberle, who was the dean of CALS, wanted to try to get a rapprochement on this tension zone that I had with Extension at that point in time. We had other Extension faculty. And he arranged a meeting with Carl O'Connor and himself and Associate Dean of LNS, and we went over there. And there was no rapprochement involved. That meeting, to the best of my recollection, was Carl O'Connor indicating, one, that I personally was trying to subvert the Extension budget process and initiatives related to their river basin work. And secondly, that my department, working through one of my colleagues in the department, also an Extension person named Brian Ohm, who had done some of the technical work on our smart growth legislation, local land use planning legislation in the state, that whole program was also being manipulated by me and others to undermine the Extension budget. And he had gone to see Catherine Lyle about this, and if it were up to him, he'd fire me, to which I said, why don't you try? And he was so confused about the budget process, he was absolutely wrong on the facts, both with regard to Ohm and myself. He tried doing some great damage to my credibility with George Meyer, the secretary of DNR, good friend of mine. I went down and got that straightened out, sent Catherine Lyle a memo with, and then I sent him a memo with all of his inaccuracies in it, and told him I thought it would probably be wise for somebody in his position to correct the record with Catherine and other people, and I carbon copied her on this kind of thing. From that point on, I never had another word with Carl O'Connor. They stayed clear of me, and I stayed clear of them. I didn't need them for what I did in terms of my public policy education, the waters of Wisconsin, the whole nonprofit world, the set of projects, student stuff, legislative engagement, national conservation work, and ongoing international component of my work. It was so full and exciting that the triviata, the administrative triviata of Extension, were absolutely meaningless to me at that point. And staying clear of them was the healthiest thing I could think about. O'Connor is long gone. People have recognized the many, many problems that came with that administrative tenure. He's an insignificant footnote in my mind in terms of his tenure in Extension for several years. It was leadership that was there, but it wasn't very stellar. Lots of problems in counties pulling out of Extension. A great lieutenant, but not a great leader. And he just got over his head, in my judgment. So continuing, Extension benefited. A few years ago, O'Connor left, retired, and Walsh only gravitated back to a specialist role in Extension, which he could perform very well. And they brought back some leadership as dean, a person who had been a program leader, Arlen Leholm, under Aisha Summersand, who was trying to kind of resurrect a lot of the linkages and build the political capital and get the Extension apparatus reinvigorated, energized, and I think he's probably doing a pretty good job at it. And it's important for urban and regional planning. They have good relationships with Extension, not just because there are some integrated faculty appointments, but because that's a great way to carry on both missions. There's enormous complementarity in this area, and Extension is an important component of it. So I've tried to give you some kind of overview of my Extension programming, the type of programming I did, and the style that I approached it with, some specifics about how it played out. You might think about putting the pieces together in particular program areas, a kind of a chronological view of Extension leadership, in which I've tried to point out points in time where I was critical, both at a chancellor's level and at a dean's level, and never accepted the notion of some deans as to challenge you and say, well, who are you to ask that question about our performance, which in fact is one of the things that a dean I have high respect for, Phil Certain, who served as dean for many years in L&S, said to me, who am I to raise that question? And I was penalized financially. They wanted to send me a signal that this was not acceptable behavior. On the other hand, it was just another example in my book. Ultimately, and I spent a lot of time, talked to a lot of colleagues. You could have got a no confidence vote if I wanted to spend time doing it for Carl O'Connor and Pat Walsh. I didn't want to do that particularly. And most people are conflict averse. If they want to do their educational work, they don't want to be engaged in the kind of geopolitics of Extension.
Right.
And I certainly understand that. But nobody really wanted to bite the bullet in that. And there are other transitions going on at Extension. So these were times of change, and I'm not sure what the future holds in this regard.
Steve, one question that I would like to ask you that I'd be interested in your comment is, what do you see as the future, not only for UW Extension, but for comparable organizations across the country, outreach affiliated with the great land-grant universities, given the cultural shift that's going on?
Well, I think that is a huge question. I think universities are asking the question in a larger sense about what they're going to look like 50 years down the road. But particularly for Extension and outreach entities, the land grant system that has been so phenomenally successful in this country, particularly as it relates to ag production, farms, but in Wisconsin, the community development and really improving the social quality of life, social and economic quality of life for citizens, so important. But suddenly, and it is suddenly, over a period of a decade or two, which increasingly looks suddenly to me, the array of providers, the internet, the ability, if you've got an issue on farm financing, if you've got an issue on new technologies that might be pertinent to your dairy herd, if you've got an issue on potato genetics, the internet becomes a source of information that can almost overload you from a whole variety of places. You can sit there at 5 a.m. watching the best authority in the United States on capital budgeting explain to you how to do farm budgeting. So the idea of having a county extension agent and a little cadre of experts there starts falling into some question, because there are many, many other nuclei, sources of information that can be tapped. And increasingly, as we move through life, we see more and more of folks in their middle ages who, as a matter of course, are used to heading to their computer screens and to the internet and to other sources of information, to suppliers, to people they work with on a contract basis for information. And the Extension leafleting, it is a race to stay ahead in terms of the outreach role of Extensions as land-grant entities in the United States. Certainly the great traditional role of providing counsel and expertise to the ag production enterprise, the traditional ag production enterprise, has probably come close to running its course. That job, it seems to me, has been done. There are points in time where I think Wisconsin had something like 15 people working on potato genetics and potato agronomy issues, and there are less than 200 potato growers in the state. That is a free consulting service for an economic enterprise that probably in the initial phases needs to be incubated, but at some point the university can't keep supporting that. The costs have to be internalized by the industry. And the notion that extension had become a handmaiden to industrialized agriculture and corporate agriculture began to raise huge issues when issues about sustainable agriculture, or about the scale of agriculture, or about the impacts of industrial agriculture and trade-offs with local food movements and organic food movements and niche markets and the response of the colleges of agriculture and extension operations to what they thought were boutique enterprises. It was hardly positive early on, although Wisconsin was better than most states in responding. So as one looks ahead, what will be the role of extension education when agencies, nonprofits, all kinds of sources of information through electronic media are available? What will be the role of extension, hands-on, in-the-trenches kind of education? And I think it's an uncertain future. I think it's an uncertain future ultimately over a decades-long period in terms of Congress's willingness to continue to support that kind of enterprise. I think extension has to be more willing to jump in and engage controversial issues. That comes with the risk of like a moth circling a candle. You need the heat, you need to engage the issues, but if you get too close and people think your objectivity is compromised, then you're a political victim, just as the moth is a victim of the flame.
Steve, I have to ask you, and perhaps this is a softball or a naive question, as comprehensive as the internet is and as wonderful as the access is to the world's best experts, don't you wonder, though, about what is lost in terms of the interaction of Professor Stephen Bourne with some group of community folks addressing the issue in an actual discussion about groundwater or watershed management?
Or land use planning,
or what,
community economic development, health care, or whatever. Sure I do. And the idea of communities having access to a talent pool that can come out and objectively talk with them is critical. Whether or not it has to be done through the that sort of community dialogue, that sort of access to information and expertise, including the personal touch that you're alluding to, I think is important. Whether it has to be done through an institutionalized structure called extension is a whole other question. Experts can be housed within the university system who do service work and this kind of outreach activity with no affiliation with extension. Joel Rogers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus and the Center on Wisconsin Strategies has worked with labor strategies, employment strategies, with communities, with disadvantaged communities. He's been out there, his people have been out there. Not a single one has any kind of an extension appointment. And so when you ask the question about the future of extension, sensu stricto as an organization, as a component of the land-grant college, that I think is an open question. In terms of the role of universities as information providers, that's a great challenge and a somewhat separate challenge, but take the area of pharmaceuticals. Are we going to get all of our information watching pharmaceutical advertising to the tune of billions of dollars a year on television as to what's good, what's not good, What are the impacts of things, how does it fit into our personal health regime? Or is there a role for the university to provide that neutral form, that objective form that's not on the take from one interest group or another financially, that can be trusted, whether it's UC Berkeley or UW-Madison, to put out useful information, to be available, to meet in public arenas, to discuss their findings, to be a challenge to those who have a strong financial stake in these kinds of things. So universities themselves can play a very important Wisconsin idea, some would call it service learning, participatory, outreach kind of role, and I think they should, not all should, but even in highly complex areas, stem cell research, the ability to translate that into terms that can be digested by the public so informed decisions can be made in this highly complex arena, and yet one that has enormous implications for human well-being, raises ethical issues for many. Those scientists have been willing to try to walk across that line and hold that dialogue, and there are lots of other fora where there are people to help in that translation process. So whether or not there'll be extensions or nonprofit think tanks or partnerships that have been formed through business and universities, the functions have to be performed. Whether or not the land grant model will continue to be the preferred vehicle, I don't know. There's been a lot of changes in extensions where long distance learning, dealing with the rapid technological innovation and communications generally, has become the domain of extension. Maintaining the facilities, creating the wherewithal for teleconferencing and video imaging and all kinds of things that are important. But then you're essentially the maintainers of the process, of the wherewithal of communication. You're not the substantive expertise that has been the hallmark of extension, which is really that transfer of knowledge from the university. And in fact, that model was anachronized. It worked well in the early 1900s, where we transferred university-based research to the public. It was perceived as sort of a one-way vector. But really, we know there's a lot to learn from practice. And even in the agricultural arena, where the land grants didn't reach out and grab rotational grazing, for example, and the grazers themselves develop schemes of rotation, networks of communication, whole new ways of reducing their capital requirements. Now, there's a wholesale way to do business for all livestock enterprises, but for a number of operations, they put this together not only without the help of extension for the most part, but with extension almost as a hostile force in many places to these kinds of changes. And the same thing happened in other areas. Extension would hardly have been the one to lead in developing the business plan for Whole Foods, for example, one of the fastest growing businesses in the United States, dealing with organic foods, quality of food, consumer information about food, in contrast to the view of large industrial agriculture. So where extension has been in Wisconsin, it's been so innovative in terms of the breadth of extension activities extending to human resources and dealing with disadvantaged communities and economic development and linking environment and development together. It's been a very powerful force. But it's become much more constrained. The county arrangement has been questioned in some counties where extension has jumped into some controversial terrain. There's often been political penalties where they've done the right thing, agricultural land preservation, education, as an example. And so I think the future is murky, and I think the burden is on both society and university extension outreach leadership to make the case for this kind of mechanism as the delivery instrument, or one of the delivery instruments, to play this role in society.
This concludes tape number 6, which is a re-interview with Professor Bourne on July 20th concerning his involvement with UW Extension. He very graciously agreed to be re-interviewed on this subject, having given an earlier interview on extension. I might note that the last 10 minutes of this interview, where he elaborated on the future of extension and its role in society, is a special edition that was not on the earlier tape. End of tape.
Well, I don't know if that was wise.